going. And then I'll introduce you. Okay, Dr. Candice Lukasik received her PhD from the University of California, Berkeley this year. Congratulations. And she's a scholar on modern day Copts. She's starting a postdoc at the Washington University of St. Louis starting this year. Again, congratulations. And also other rewards that she got, but she can talk about it later. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Hanny, for that introduction. So I won't waste any time. I'll get started on my presentation. So the title of my presentation today is Modern Day Martyrs, Coptic Blood and American Christian Kinship. Today's paper is part of a forthcoming article in American Anthropologist that should be out early next year. Today is just part of the argument of that article. And I'm really looking forward to comments, questions, suggestions for book revisions, because this is, I think, one of the central arguments of the book, tentatively. But again, like, these ideas are still in development as I think towards the book. And just as kind of a disclaimer, all the names of my interlocutors in this presentation, the folks that I mentioned, have been changed. So on a winter afternoon, Romani Melek Hetta, a Coptic Christian asylum seeker, visited the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., waiting for a friend from the local Coptic Orthodox Church to arrive. He sat on a bench on the museum premises. A woman and man from the managerial staff of the museum approached and began questioning him. Romani grew uncomfortable, ended the conversation, and entered the museum without his friend. A while later, security officers approached Romani and directed him into a private room. The managerial staff and security officers began interrogating him about his friend, why he had not come, and who he was. The museum eventually advised the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, that Romani was a possible terrorist and a security threat, and opened a counterterrorism investigation into him. To preserve his asylum claim, he agreed to an interview with the FBI to clear his name. During the interview, Romani was informed that the museum believed him to be a potential or a possible security threat because he used both legal names, Hitta and Malik, claiming that this usage was particularly common among Muslim terrorists. Romani filed a lawsuit against the Museum of the Bible in early 2019, citing that the museum spuriously caused his personal information to be entered into FBI counterterrorism files. In a subsequent interview on the case, Romani lamented that such people, the museum staff, would, quote, never be able to comprehend there is a Christian person who doesn't look like them, end quote. In recent years, American politicians, think tanks, and NGOs have channeled their efforts into supporting, saving Middle Eastern Christians, especially in the wake of the Arab Spring and the rise of the Islamic State. Over the past decade, Copts have increasingly immigrated to the United States by means of the diversity visa or green card lottery, asylum, and family reunification. The growth of the Coptic community in the U.S., along with lobbying efforts and a rise in ISIS-affiliated attacks on their places of worship and pilgrimage in Egypt, have pushed them into the political spotlight. Since the 1990s, attacks on Egyptian Copts have been made legible to American, particularly evangelical audiences, through the global moral imaginary of the persecuted church, which argues that Christians around the globe are persecuted more than any other time in history. Once the objects of American missionary efforts, Egyptian Copts have now become reconfigured as Americans' Christian kin in their suffering for Christ. And politically active and affluent American Copts have engaged this imaginary in their lobbying efforts, advocacy, and social interactions. American persecution discourse has restructured Christian kinship along these imperial lines. Images of bloodied Egyptian Coptic bodies and their hagiographic accounts of witness to Christ have circulated among Western Christian religio-political networks in what I term an economy of blood, an imperial economy of Christian kinship that performs the double movement of glory and racialization. In one movement, the suffering of Coptic Christians in Egypt is theologically engaged by American evangelicals and their kin as a triumphalist vision of Western Christendom. Thus, the persecuted church has positioned the strengthening of Western Christianity on the death of Eastern Christians, like the Copts, who purify the faith and strengthen claims of besiegement. In another movement, American Copts of many different social classes are racialized as Middle Eastern, Arab, Muslim, non-white others, by the actual administrative apparatus of government within war on terror itineraries of securitization, like in the case of Romani Melek Hetta. The racialization of American Copts is a dual process oscillating between Christian kinship with white America and the optics of non-white suspicion. Racialization is a multi-scalar process that proliferates through these different religio-racial divisions within the geopolitics of persecution. Western Christians mobilize Eastern Christian suffering, yet those Christians ultimately remain Eastern, non-white exemplars for imperial discourses of kinship. This double movement has placed American Copts in a bind, whereby indigenous Coptic collective memory of blood and persecution has intersected with the political, theological, and effective formations of this economy of blood. These binds shape the contours of American Coptic politics, as well as processes of communal formation and potential solidarities with other minority communities within the United States. Given my limited time today, my talk will focus on the second part of this movement, racialization. Drawing from my fieldwork in the United States, I aim to open up a conversation on everyday forms of discrimination and racism and gesture towards the logics of differentiation, how American Copts separate themselves from the figure of the Middle Eastern Arab Muslim other in post 9/11 America. And I just wanna note, and possibly this will come up in the questions or suggestions or comments, that in general, my field work for my doctoral work took place between 2016, 2018, 15 months of field work between Upper Egypt and the United States, primarily in the US along the East Coast in the New York, New Jersey area, but also elsewhere. On a cold winter evening in Staten Island, I sat across from Abuna Girgis in the kitchen of the administrative center of the local Coptic diocese. In his late 30s and recently elevated to the priesthood, Abuna grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey, and has strong ties to his clergy-filled family back in Upper Egypt, visiting them regularly. We talked about protests that had stalled zoning board approval of Bayonne's first mosque. The same zoning board approved the expansion of a Coptic church in 2011. After purchasing the property in 2015, the local Muslim community's proposal was denied by the zoning board in early 2017, citing traffic and parking issues. The property was protested and even vandalized, with crude phrases such as F Muslims and F Arabs tagged with the name of Donald Trump, then Republican nominee for president. Bayonne is a working class neighborhood where historically many Italian, Polish, and Irish immigrant communities took up residence. More recently, Bayonne has become home to many Middle Eastern communities, including and especially Egyptians, both Muslim and Coptic Christian. When he was growing up though, Abuna's family was one of the few Middle Eastern families, saying, quote, "You could tell even at that age that people weren't used to your complexion. They weren't comfortable with having people of your complexion around." Now, the community has two Coptic Orthodox churches and is expanding with a new influx of Coptic immigrants from Egypt. Though the community also faces its own share of discrimination, some Copts joined in the protests against the Bayonne Mosque. Protesters held signs that said, "Stop the mosque. If the mosque comes, the mayor goes. No mosque, remember 9/11. I asked Abuna Girgis what he thought about the protests in his hometown. Well, look, he answered. If you're Coptic, you're going to protest Islam. When you've seen and gone through the harassment, the persecution in Egypt and everything, can you blame them? End quote. Coptic protests against mosques and their engagement in such rhetoric, I argue, are practices that aim to both secure their recognition as Christians in contemporary American contexts of suspicion, but importantly also reflect communal trauma manifesting itself in diaspora. Later in the conversation, Abuna recounted how he and a group of friends had stopped at the local 7-Eleven on the evening of September 11, 2001. While there, he began to be heckled by a group of men whom he took to be Hispanic, who hurled insults at him. "We had the wrong complexion," he recounted. They said to us, "You effing terrorists, look what you did. We're going to get you. After 9-11, you felt like you were a target and it wasn't your fault," end quote. A local priest in the days following 9-11 even went under house arrest because of his supposed resemblance to Osama bin Laden, one Coptic interlocutor recounted. Others noted that Pope Shenouda III, the late patriarch of the Coptic Orthodox Church, allowed priests to wear a wooden cross similar to Catholic clergy and to trim their beards in the hope that they would not be the targets of backlash or hate crimes after 9-11. Coptic religious practices, such as priestly garb, have reformed in diaspora to reconcile with post 9-11 racial infrastructures that code such aesthetics as threatening. The power of whiteness within American society is structured in and through such disciplinary measures and everyday relations, and the transformation of Coptic religious and social life in the US gestures to the power of white Western Christianity. Copts are Eastern Christians, yet they must contend with and are transformed by an imperial and geopolitical form of Christianity, one that is intertwined with the power and privilege of whiteness. Such racial distinctions have never been tethered to a defined set of categories, whereby avoiding detection in those categories, name, dress, language, would somehow help to avoid the white gaze. Especially after 9-11, many Copts were identified by law enforcement as potential threats. Magdi Bishara was the Coptic owner of the St. George's Shell gas station in Bayville, New Jersey. Shortly after 9-11, the FBI came to the family's home in the middle of the night, questioning Magdi as to whether Marwan al-Shahi, one of the 9-11 hijackers, had worked at the gas station. His stepson, Michael, described to me the aftermath of the initial FBI raid, saying, quote, "People would drive by and say, 'We're going to kill you, terrorists,' and throw a liquor bottle at me and my sister," end quote. Under the Patriot Act, the government confiscated anything they desired from the gas station and their home. Their mail was opened, phones tapped, and Michael was followed to school by federal agents. The family faced death threats, and despite pleas to the police to intervene, they refused. Michael described how the incident forced him to differentiate, quote, "It made me feel weird to say out loud, but I always thought to myself, I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Christian. I felt like I was putting them down to say, 'Hey, look, I'm the good guy.' I felt like we had to do anything to defend ourselves," end quote. At school, Michael was bullied and physically assaulted on dozens of occasions. At one point in the month following the raid, an unknown assailant set the family's house on fire while Michael and his little sister were sleeping. All of this took place even after the FBI notified Magdi Bishara that he was no longer a subject of investigation. As Junaid Renna has described, racial infrastructure by means of cultural and institutional forms of discrimination interact with one another in a complex social system of racialization. Yet the process of racialization is never complete. Identifying who is the Muslim is part of the apparatus of racialization. As Maggie Bishara noted during an interview after the FBI raid of his gas station, he said, quote, "Middle Eastern people, we all look alike. You know what I mean." Strategies of separation evidence Coptic desire to disentangle from post 9/11 racial infrastructures to not be identified as the enemy. But they also show how pervasive logics of whiteness work within marginalized communities as they interweave with transnational histories of persecution and intercommunal violence. Tony, a Coptic rights activist, came to the United States in the 1970s. Today, he's part of a broad network of Christian, mainly white, conservative activists aiming to demonstrate that, quote, the fundamental teachings of Islam are incompatible with the Christian faith and the American way of life, unquote. At his home, Tony gave me copies of his books he has written under a pseudonym. Inside one of the books, it reads, "Dedication to my precious grandchildren. It is my prayer that you will never have to go through what I once did in my Islamic mother country. May you never have to flee America because it turned to Islam," end quote. The text expressed his fear of America's conversion to Islam, a need to uphold traditional Judeo-Christian values, and arguments for Islam's inherent irrationality. Tony told me he does this work because he feels guilty for leaving Egypt, end quote. 40 years ago in Egypt, you couldn't tell the difference between a Christian and a Muslim. Now all women are wearing hijab. The Islamization of Egypt is the culprit. I mean, they were Muslims back then, but they have become Islamicized now, end quote. In contrast to Tony's polemical writings on Islam, his own migration memoir describes a number of incidents of Muslim friendship which defined his upbringing. In one memory, he speaks about his Arabic teacher, Mr. Muhammad, saying, quote, "Mr. Muhammad was more than just a teacher, as he also supervised the class, paying attention to ethics and religion without any biases." One day, a fellow Muslim student made a joke mocking Christianity to the dismay of Tony and his Coptic classmates. The teacher proceeded to corporally punish the Muslim student, which Tony tried to fend off. The teacher insisted on giving the Muslim student a punishment. And Tony writes this, "That was the first time I ever heard of justice's rights in Egypt. Never again did I hear about Madam Justice, and I don't know if she has left the country or passed away," end quote. While much Western discussion on Egyptian Copts centers around their persecution, Christian Muslim life in contemporary Egypt is also centered on pedagogies of negotiation and ambiguity. The economy of blood incites American Copts engaged in advocacy and conservative politics into certain narratives and binds them into particular strategies of differentiation from the Middle Eastern Arab Muslim other, ultimately effacing the fullness of transnational Coptic life. As more Copts immigrate to and build family in the U.S., histories of persecution and sectarian violence in Egypt are remapped onto a transnational economy of blood, reconfiguring Christian kinship through American empire building. The blood of Coptic martyrs relates them as kin to Western Christians, building community in blood and by blood. Yet, American Copts are placed into racial partition. Blood includes and simultaneously excludes in white Christian America. These different Christian concepts of kinship and the broader political imaginary such conceptions have historically authorized require a multi-scalar approach to analyzing how Christianity and whiteness as structures of global power play out within a geopolitically important community like the Copts. For while the diaspora offers opportunity to form new solidarities and pathways of reparation and reconciliation, a geopolitical constellation of forces continues to suture Coptic Christians to itineraries of global Christian persecution and this economy of blood. Ultimately, liberation from these structures of recognition must include the transformation and reevaluation of community beyond the geopolitics of persecution. It is here where creative forms of solidarity and kinship among American Copts and excluded others can be forged. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions and comments.
Thank you very much, Candace. Please write your comments. I hit the wrong one. There's a time delay. But in case we don't catch comments now, we're going to have some time later on. And silence reigned in the land. Okay, here is a comment. So, in your book, will you expand on the premise that American Christians have a confounded idea of blood? That's from Daniel Hanna.
Yes, thank you, Daniel. So actually during the postdoc, I plan on exploring the particularities of American evangelical relations to and theological understandings of blood and kinship. I do this briefly in the article in terms of talking about the first movement, thinking about glory. So a lot of the article focuses on the interactions between at conferences and different events between American politicians that usually ascribe to be to describe themselves as Christians, whether that be Catholic, evangelical, whatever else, and church hierarchy. And also conferences in Washington, D.C., where these interactions happen. And so the book will certainly explore those. But to be honest, I'm actually really trying to contend at the moment with and pushing against the book becoming about American evangelicals. I really want this book to be about how these broader power structures in the United States have an effect on Coptic communities here and how those reverberate back to, so I work in a rural area in Upper Egypt, how those conversations and those discourses reverberate back even to the most kind of remote of places in Egypt. There's a question from Samara. She perceived that the diaspora pressure to identify with white Christians and against fellow Egyptians who aren't Christians will cause issues in the relationship between diaspora and still indigenous Copts as well. Is that already happening? Do you think that gets worse? And thank you so much for that question. So I think this is also quite ambiguous. I think that there's not really one answer to this. I think my main concern with and why the book, as the dissertation did, always kind of reflects back on how these conversations are perceived in Egypt, like how folks in rural Egypt, for example, are receiving these conversations. So like whether it's through like family in the United States or news media or whatever else or Facebook posts, et cetera. I'm really interested in how they kind of interpret these discussions in the U.S. through an Egyptian religious and political context, right? So how those like translations are happening back and forth. My main concern though is how these particular interactions in the U.S. context with people in power have an effect on everyday Christian-Muslim relations in Egypt. Right, so it's not just like Copts in Egypt, right, that are hearing about what the diaspora, the interactions with diasporic activists and others are having here. But there's a lot of questions. I will take note of that. Thank you so much.
Melanie had a question, yep. Michael Saad had a. Oh, okay. Let's see.
Also Sayedna.
Let's go with Sayedna because he was the next one.
Yeah, okay, sorry. So with the recent racial profiling of African Americans and the death of George Floyd, and what you've discussed today of racial profiling Copts in white America, what do you see as the solution of changing this mindset? Solution. I'm usually not, which is quite bad about many folks in academia. I don't know if there's kind of like one ready-made solution to this, right? And one of the things that I proposed at the end, and it's not necessarily that I have a pathway forward for this, is for cops to see themselves as family, as kin with other marginalized folks in the United States, rather than American evangelicals, right? So for example, one of the concerns I have, personal concerns I have, is somebody like Jeff Sessions, who came out, there was an interview with him in the New York Times earlier this summer, and he said essentially, we need somebody, like a strong ruler, like they have in Egypt. He's talking about his affiliation to Trump. And he's like, because, Sisi protects Christians, the persecuted Christians, and we are also persecuted as evangelicals in the United States. That kind of parallelness, that kind of way in which cops are like American evangelicals' kin, that produces a particular separation in many ways at the local level as to who many of the cops, and again, this is differentiated by class too, but I'll say something more general, how politically active cops choose to affiliate themselves. Sorry, there's like so many questions, so I apologize. But thank you for that question, Sayedna.
Dr. Michael Saad is the next one.
Dr. Saad, thank you. How would you compare the incident of the Museum of the Bible with the USA-wide persecution of Nick Sandman by national leaders, media? That's a very interesting question. And it gets to my answer to Sayedna as well just now, in that, the use of persecution discourse and how the Egyptian Coptic experience is paralleled with the American evangelical experience is particularly problematic, right? Because it kind of flattens power differentials, right? Copts are a minority in Egypt, okay? They are not the ones holding power, right? Racially, religiously, whatever else. And so in the flattening of cops who are persecuted or racialized in the United States with, conservative Christians who take on that rhetoric, I think produces, one, even more binds for cops in the United States politically, right? And it really affects the ways that they can form different solidarities, like whether that be at the local level, who they see as like family, who they see as their neighbors, right? So I'll leave that it at that.
Next is
Dr. Nelly. Yes, thank you so much. Have you found many Christian communities that work towards increasing more understanding about the cops among USA Christians, okay? And do they have any influence on public opinion? It seems there is a huge disconnect between certain evangelical groups, other Christian denominations, and the current persecution-focused discourse that comes from the government. Yes, very true. So, yeah. I mean, in my field work, if I'm gonna be frank, I'm sure that there are, so there's a lot of, how can I say, there's a lot of kind of different local forms of solidarity, right? So I'll give an example, like in my field work in New York, particularly because I did field work in 2017. So, obviously there was a number of bombings that happened. So there was a number of events between different religious leaders coming out to like support cops, right, in that moment. And I'm sure that this also happened in Los Angeles and elsewhere. But the way that folks during those meetings kind of understood themselves and their positionality vis-a-vis cops was also one of, this is our Christian brethren. They are martyred. We are also persecuted, et cetera. So like that same discourse does come out even at the local level. So that is what my fieldwork lent itself to in terms of that particular question. I do have another year, and I have another fellowship this year to do a little bit more fieldwork in other places in the United States. So a little bit more possibly in Los Angeles and in the Southern US, and now in St. Louis. So It opens up kind of some different geographical perspectives. But yeah, I'll keep that in mind. I think one of the things that I've come across is like the pervasiveness of persecution discourse, like ultimately defines like who cops are and can be for other American Christians. And that's what is particularly problematic when we try to understand how cops are also discriminated against in the United States as non-white others, right? Not only cops, but like other Middle Eastern Christians, whether, you know, they be Lebanese or whoever else, like for white America, what is your name? You know, what color are you? The ways in which like there are different markers that that in everyday life, folks identify you as the other. I hope that was sufficient answer to your question, and I appreciate it.
Last question is from Peter.
Peter, thank you for your question. Do you find a significant difference of thought in the reception of violent events between American-born cops versus those who have immigrated? Yeah, very, very good question. If so, is there a more reconciliatory attitude by those who have not lived in Egypt? The issue as it presents itself here in America with regards to social reception of cops seems to be more in line with distancing themselves from an Egyptian identity and gravitating towards a Coptic identity, whether religious or not. Does that hold to be consistent for those who do not identify as practicing Coptic Christian cops? These are excellent, excellent questions, and I don't think we have enough time to go through all of them. One thing that I will say is a lot of like what I'm kind of recounting here, and this is why I focus on racialization rather than the glory aspect of things in this presentation, is that there is a difference across class, right? Like, so for folks for American cops in the United States, who some of which like who have never visited Egypt or don't have like those direct connections, as, for example, like folks who recently immigrated, who are asylum seekers, who you know, work at a gas station 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, in New Jersey, and you know, have like their frame of reference is Egypt, right? And so, in many ways, like how they understand different incidents that happen in Egypt is through an Egyptian lens, not necessarily like through an American political one. I'm not trying to kind of essentialize all these folks, but these are the things that I observed during my field work. And so there is definitely a difference, even in the United States, between different classes of cops, right? And you know, when they immigrated, what their perception is, who is in their social network, right? Are Egyptian Muslims like more, are they connected to more Egyptian Muslims than they are other Eastern Orthodox Christians? This is also a class thing. This is also a generational thing, right? We have many cops in the United States who attend theological schools, right? And their interactions are mainly with Eastern Orthodox, maybe some other Oriental Orthodox folks. But for, you know, friends who are working, you know, interlocutors who are working, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and many of them are working with fellow immigrants. Those are not their, you know, those are not their kin. Those are not their family in the United States, and they're more connected back to Egypt. And so they interpreted those incidents differently. And I think that addresses a little bit your second question. So the last one, quite interesting. I also think that this has to do with the kind of gravitating towards Coptic identity vis-a-vis Egyptian. What it was noted to me during my field work is that Egyptian, how many white folks in the United States like perceive Egyptian is to be Muslim, right? And so to distance oneself from that identity, from that form of racialization, there's this gravitation in one way toward the Coptic identity, right? How we are different from those Egyptian Muslims. And this has not always historically been that, right? Like Shoei Koros, for example, talked about this in the 80s in quite a different way than in post 9/11 United States. And so I think that there is a way that in a post 9/11 America, there is this push to separate from Egypt and focus on one's Christian identity. But I would also add, though, that there are many, you know, secular, non-religious folks who identify as Copts and are reclaiming Coptic identity as a cultural one. One also in which Shoei Kroos, one of the earliest immigrants to the United States, also championed as well, both a religious and a cultural Coptic identity. So sorry if I went over my time, and I appreciate everybody's questions, and I will be taking note of all of these. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you very much, and we'll have some time for further questions after Dr. Saad's presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.